Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we all need to be working together in demanding full compliance with the Constitution. We're providing you with the content. We're providing with the source documents. We're providing you with the knowledge that this is the irrefutable way forward. Our forefathers knew what to do and they did it. And because they did it with faith. Because they did that with faith, I think they were blessed. Now, it wasn't about getting out there and holy rolling and saying you got to be a Puritan, no, you got to be an Anglican, no, you got to be a Congressionalist. Put those things aside. We got to put our differences aside. It's not about saving souls. It is about saving the Constitution. And they, at their time, they were focused about creating that. But they had to go through, I believe, the fire's furnace, or I should say, you know, the belly of the beast, so that they would be refined to a point and prepared to create that Constitution. Folks, there's not much difference with us today. We are literally in the belly of the beast. We're going through it, and it's about time for our aha moment to say, if we do not unify on the full compliance to the entire Constitution and get our government in compliance, that's all we need to do. And all we need are our representatives to do this. Because the representatives control the courts. The representatives control the law. They can actually, you know, tax us to death, which is what they're doing. Because they're actually spending money on things they have no authority to do. But when we replace them with absolute people that understand they are tied and limited by these constitutions we create and why we need to create a county constitution. So it may seem like I'm jumping around, but some of you are already starting to understand this. Some of you that have taken the time and the due diligence reading Why Counties Matter Most, going through this curriculum that we repeat every year. And I know people miss this, they miss that. You know, and now this, you know, they're able to connect maybe a few more dots together. There's no reason why we can't be successful other than the fact that we just need to actually act. I think the real problem is that there are good people that just are apprehensive in standing up and saying, we got to go do this. All that being said, I don't want to take the entire, you know, first half of the show in a monologue poking people in the eye or what have you. The fact is that we need to continually learn, pray, and act. We're here to give you the knowledge you need, to what you need to pray for. We need to unite on the Constitution and start holding every public servant accountable. And that has to start with our representatives. Once they actually hold themselves accountable, then they won't have any reservations about holding judges accountable, holding executives accountable. And so this is where I get the chance to bring in Tammy and Sean. So what say you? Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So that makes sense, right? If we start holding our representatives accountable, and they're willing to be held accountable, do you think that they would bat an eye in holding a judge accountable to their oath?
No. There's a lot of people out there who are jumping, you know, faunching at the bit to actually be in position to do that.
There we go. Okay, so, and I think that was a concurrence from Tammy as well, right? I mean, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you were saying the representatives control the court, also
yep.
control the laws, but I actually think that's just... That's just such a foreign concept nowadays because we're so used to thinking that the court
because,
is the highest.
Because we think we have been trained and indoctrinated to look at our Republican form of government the way they want us to look at it. And actually, if you really look at the way what they're telling us is that you're Republican informed, you need to be Republican informed, but the judiciary will tell you how that's to be. The judiciary are our gods, or our demigods at least, you know, and they control us. We need to go to them, and they will make sure, they will do us right. And, you know, when you really look at most of the judges, most of them are appointed, and the few that get elected, you know, it's not like they're elected on the record or are on anything regarding the Constitution. I think, you know, dismantling the bar, and I think dismantling, you know, the entire legal system and restoring our common law, and then actually letting everybody understand that what has been delegated to the state is the only thing that state court has jurisdiction over. So one of the things that just came up recently, and then we're going to get into the closing out of the Kentucky resolutions, is the Santa Clara case that I think is 1886, something like that. The Santa Clara case is a keystone or a foundational case that created what we call the justification of personhood for the corporations. Now, the dispute, the controversy in this case was that the railroad company, which was a California corporation, didn't like the way the county was taxing them differently or whatever. It didn't matter because the city was a California city, Santa Clara, California city, and a California corporation. And so if there's no laws in the Constitution of whatever Santa Clara was doing, and they came up with their own guides of what to do, then it's done. But what the real motive behind this, because corporations have been trying and trying in the backboard, you know, in the boardrooms and so forth, their intent was to get out from underneath the states. When they start working at a national level, corporations can then take advantage of states, because the states can't protect their citizens anymore. The federal government will allow the polluting. The federal government will allow these things. When technically, when we really look in reconfiguring our state, you want to have your county more in control and have more say over business and anything operating within your county, more so than the state. You don't want the state to be in a position to say, suck it up, buttercup. We don't care if people die over there. We all need the money, or we all need this or that. The further away the decision gets from the problem, the greater disconnect you will deal with. And in other words, the greater tyranny you may be suspect to. So anyway, in looking at this, you know, we have to, and I wanted to bring this in because this is a huge case. And this is a huge point where the courts redefine the 14th Amendment of equal protection, because the intent behind a corporate leader and lawyer, as well as the corporation, the specific railroad company, whatever they were literally trying to claim that a corporation had the equal protections under the Constitution, where there was no language in the Constitution for the federal government to even say the word corporation. Corporations were entities that were state-managed, controlled, and regulated. But the courts started opening their arms and dealing with directly with corporations in Commerce Clause effects. But technically, the Constitution... So, Sean, open up Article 1, Section 8. And tell me what is it, the third clause or second clause, that Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and
between the states?
Among the states.
Among the states.
Not among the corporations of the states, among the states. So how is it that they started opening up? Because Marshall wanted to expand jurisdiction to anything and everything. And so as the Ogden case of, I think it was 1824, Ogden v. something, I forget. But it was a, that was the first corporation, one of the first corporation cases. And I think it was about ferrying between New Jersey and New York. But nevertheless, they opened their doors to a case they had no business opening their doors to. They were there, and actually, if they're going to be regulating commerce, what would have happened was New Jersey or New York, the state, would have made an appeal to the federal court saying, hey, we've got a problem. We have a corporation that, you know, we're there, that is operating under the auspices of the state, our state, and we're dealing with New York, and New York is not playing, or they're keeping us from selling our product over there, whatever it is. If it is a legitimate claim for the Commerce Clause in the Constitution, that means state to state, then it has to be a state court issue. In other words, I should say it has to be a legal issue that is driven by the state attorney general, the state governor, whomever, the legislature, to say the Commerce Clause is being violated because we have a business within our state that cannot do business with the new state of New York. But to allow a corporation to walk into the court as the plaintiff, that is a problem, a huge problem, folks, because the federal government has no jurisdiction to even deal with those folks. That, and so, well, I mean, if a light all of a sudden, you know, brightened up and illuminated wherever you are, just drive careful because we don't want you driving off the road because of the cause of these lights and things. But I'm just being funny. Trying to be funny, at least. So, anywho, let's get into the Kentucky resolutions, 1799, and we're basically closing out what Jefferson was asserting. Now, I forget who was saying. Let me do the due diligence here. Any go backs, anything? Because, and actually, the whole point of bringing up this whole court case, by the way, was to kind of help everybody understand. This interposition and the redefining by the court has no compunction. There's nothing that constrains them from redefining anything and everything under the sun. I'm not surprised, or I wouldn't be surprised, if they actually started redefining the atonement and salvation for us as well, because they believe they have that level of power. And it's a sad day. It's a very sad day, because what we're speaking to is a judiciary form of government, not a monarchical. You know, these guys in black robes who possess something greater than all of us. And when they're all in the room together, boy, that is the power that opens up heaven. At least so they think. Anyway, you know, and if any judge ever listens to me, and I'm sure they go, I'd love to have that guy in my courtroom. And you know what, folks? We see people abused in the court systems left and right. If you find me cut up in the freezer, don't believe the suicide notes.
Right.
Okay. All right. So where did we leave off, or was there anything we wanted to go back and cover?
I made a note that asking how could the other states possibly disagree with the resolutions and claim federal judiciary had the interpretive role.
So the people,
because that was all over the Wikipedia entry that I'd found and we kind of touched on.
Yeah, so the people in office made a decision, and their decision was based on their biases, not biased on the truth and how the Constitution was ratified and how the Constitution was specified in the ratification debates and in the Constitutional Convention. These people chose to interpret implication, and they chose to basically say, hey, we are okay with the courts being the final arbiters. That's what we want. So, in other words, the people that were in office at that point were probably former anti-federalists who came over into the Federalist camp, because the anti-federalists were trying to do anything and everything to stop the Constitution. What happened to the Anti-Federalist Party? The Constitution went into effect. The Bill of Rights were ratified. They lost any ground in arguing and taking on a point. Did it mean that they were going to hang up their hat and their coat of, you know, politicking and put away their soapbox? No, these people were politicians to the core. These people had to find a new way to, you know, inject themselves so that they could create their own cabal, and they went right in with the open arms of Hamilton and the other big government Federalists that were hiding in the recesses. These weren't the ones that were actually speaking during the ratification debates. Most of those people that actually spoke up during the ratification debates, because Tammy, I know you've read these things. If you look, I think, who was it, Ames? I think Ames was one of the guys that argued for the bank bill. If you go through the Massachusetts ratification meeting, how often did Ames even speak? Not at all. I don't remember any citations that we provide from Ames. So what that tells me is Ames wasn't an ardent supporter of the Constitution for its purity. He may have been a supporter of the Constitution with the intent to subvert it, like Hamilton. There were people like that that were in the Federalist group. And the Anti-Federalists quickly went and they started hugging and holding hands. And they're saying, great, now we have even a bigger cabal where everybody can get rich. Because the people that were the Anti-Federalists in the states, they weren't doing it to actually create, you know, to protect the best government ever. They were doing it to protect their interest, their control, their financial control, their positions that their state had with the rest of the world. We go through this all the time as we go through the ratification debates. The six states that vigorously debated were the six states that had the greatest economies. They had the most to lose because they were in control and taking advantage of the small states. That's why the small states rubber stamped. I mean, they literally rubber stamped the Constitution practically. They didn't vigorously debate it. It took them 1 week to all, yeah, this is going to be a good thing for us. It's going to protect us from the crap we're already dealing with the Articles of Confederation. And the way things are going, because all the states are ignoring it. If this works for us, this will be great. And it did. It was supposed to, and it did technically work. But even people within those states became a part of the cabal. This, you know, the ability to print money and get it into the pockets of other politicians, so they started benefiting. And Hamilton was corrupting everybody. So, or as many people that wanted to be corrupted, Hamilton was, hey, there's plenty of room for you here. As long as we got paper and ink over there in the press, we're good. Anyway, hopefully that answered the question.
Yes, sir, it did.
So, Tammy, I think we kind of left off, and we may have dove into the highlights at the very end of Resolution 4. So were you reading, or was it Sean's turn, or what? Whoever.
I think I was reading.
Okay.
And we were on the yellow part at the very end.
Okay, so go ahead and just finish off that, and Sean can read the final paragraph.
All right.
Thank you.
But although this Commonwealth, as a party to the federal compact, will bow to the laws of the Union, yet it does not at the same time declare that it will not now nor ever hereafter cease to oppose in a constitutional manner every attempt from what quarter soever offered to violate that compact.
Okay,
actually,
so
we read that part.
Yeah, we did. I know that. But I mean, it's good to reiterate that, because that was the gist of why they weren't nullifying. In other words, Thomas Jefferson said it's every state's right to nullify. You can leave the Union and nullify. But what he basically was saying is we're going to stay in this because we're going to continue to declare and continue to oppose all of these unconstitutional things. We're not going to go away, which was great. Because this is what I say today. I know that there's many states like Wyoming that if they really looked at where they were, shoot, secession, and saying, you know what, this is definitely not the government that we signed on to. And, you know, we're out. We're seceding. And then if the federal government, oh, well, you entered this thing into your constitution that says you're an inseparable part of the Union. And then you say, well, yeah, that's because you told us we had to write that. But technically, in the founding documents, it says here clearly we have the right to nullify, we have the right to leave the union, and regardless of what you say and told us to write, you know, this counters that because these are primary source documents. This is how the Constitution and this union was built. And, oh, by the way, when we joined the union, one to, you know, as a state to the states. That's the union. You're not the union. You're the general government that services the union. How did you become the boss of the union? I mean, there's all sorts of arguments that I would start just, you know, I'd get all my fingers in good shape before I'd get up there, and then I'd be poking them with, you know, my pinkies and my all my digits. Because, you know, they can't win this argument. It is because we said so. Well, that doesn't fly in a world of law, a world of hard facts, fact and law. And the court seems to love to obviate those things. So, Sean, let's go ahead and read the fifth paragraph, and that will, you know, get us into the setting the stage for the next document, Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions. Go ahead.
And finally, in order that no pretext or arguments may be drawn from a supposed acquiescence on the part of this Commonwealth in the constitutionality of those laws, and be thereby used as precedents for similar future violations of federal compact, this Commonwealth does now enter against them its solemn protest.
There you go. It's solemn protest against these laws. And so there, anyway, what do you think? I'm hoping that those people who are under this belief of, you know, single state nullification realizes that there is a requirement that if it's willful and material, you can nullify, but you need to leave the union. We will get into Madison's notes on nullification of when you have the justification to the union. And in other words, nobody in the union can fault you for doing exactly what you're doing. And as a matter of fact, there are things, but see, why is it? Because the John Birchers, the 10th Amendment Center, there's lots of people that go out there and say you can do these things, but they're not teaching you the real reason behind that, why, how, and what. And so I think it's interesting that they just want you to go and carelessly do it so that any little federal law you don't like, you can just get rid of. And no. So we'll get into the justification and all that behind that. But that right there kind of closes us out regarding, you know, the nullification and Jefferson's part of this process, because he didn't give a lot of details. He was very quick and to the point. I mean, he's a very succinct lawyer. Well, I shouldn't say that, right? I speak out of one side of my mouth, and he proved me wrong. Because when you read the eighth resolution, where it was like two sentences, a page and a half, two sentences. So, I mean, he can really expound and expound and expound, but he didn't take the time to get into the academics. And even Madison did not. Madison just used the specific term interposition. But in the report, now that we're getting into that, in the report, Madison clearly lays out this little, what he does is he exposes people to the truth of the concept of our constitutions and our form of government. He starts helping people understand that this all is based, everything we've done is based on the tenets of contract law. And we've executed a compact for the states in creating this federal government with very limited powers in a form of something very similar and akin to a power of attorney. And it's a very limited, not a general power of attorney, a very limited and defined power of attorney. And even in this power of attorney, we create limits upon ourselves as states. And so we're going into the break. When we come back, we will start off with Madison's report. And we will go through this. We're going to go through this line by line like we've done the other ones. And you're going to see that Madison starts giving you the background. He starts telling you what he said and why he said it. And then he's going to, after he gets through a few of the resolutions, he's really going to get deep into the argument. So we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so here we go, diving into a report that was provided by Madison in January of 1800. Now, what we just read that Thomas Jefferson signed off was promulgated on December 1999. So the election year is 1800, right? Right? If I've got everybody back. So the election years are on the even, right? So for 1800, that was the election year where Madison, or actually Jefferson, was elected. Jefferson was inaugurated in 1801. Madison was elected in 1808 and inaugurated in 1809. And the inauguration back in those days was back in March time frame, or in March, not in January. And so what we're looking at is the conclusion of Jefferson's resolutions of 1799, lamenting and everything else. I believe that prior to the point he sent that out, there was already discussion of taking the action of running a campaign through the states on constitutional compliance. Huh, interesting. Instead of, you know, taking up arms, because if I remember correctly, it was around the time of the Constitution, prior to the Constitution, that Jefferson pointed out that the Tree of Liberty needed to be refreshed with blood every 20 years. Everybody remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
And so Jefferson's
Patriots.
Yes, and so Jefferson's attitude obviously had changed now. Now he realized that, one, there was a process called interposition or republic review in holding the federal government accountable. And if that didn't work, then it would to be basically awaken the people to what is dooming or what is looming on, you know, the other, outside that ridgeline. Just on the other side of that ridgeline is a fire that's going to engulf us if we don't get involved now and get these people out of office. So he started a campaign, and how much time did he have campaigning? A year. And we're not talking about national TV, satellite radio, and this blitz of media. We're talking about, by word of mouth, you know, a very cumbersome getting the word out. How many states were in the Union in 1800? Anybody know?
No.
Okay. Tammy, any idea? Do you have any idea how many states there were in the Union?
13? I don't know.
So, if I remember correctly, so we had 13, and then three joined very quickly, which was Vermont, Tennessee, and Kentucky, not in that order. And I believe by that point, we also had another state, or I should say, yeah, I think there was another state joining the Union. And so as I'm kind of stalling because I'm actually looking at for a spreadsheet. 16?
16 states.
Okay, so there's only three. In other words, we didn't have the fourth state join yet. Okay, that's fine. So 16 states.
Yeah, the original 13 plus Vermont, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
Tennessee, okay. I thought that there was possibly another state that was coming in or almost ready. Ohio was one of them.
Ohio, they came in 1803.
Okay. And New Orleans was a little bit around there, but I thought there may have been something else. But, like, well, Mississippi was next. I don't know if Alabama. Alabama, is that in between Georgia and Mississippi, right? So, anyway, nevertheless, the nation has grown by these, especially by two of these big states, you know, going through and into the Appalachians and the Cumberland Gap and all of that. Getting the word throughout the Tennessee, Kentucky, all the way down to Georgia and all the way up to Vermont and New Hampshire now. In 1 year, that's a huge effort, huge. Especially for an acting vice president. So I think that probably Madison had to take the responsibility in spending time in communicating with the electors in the previous elections, because this is how they did it. They got the word out to the electors. In other words, they already had a network. See, if we were following the Constitution, there would already be a network of people who are functioning within the Constitution and choosing the president and the vice president and understanding the importance of following the Constitution and so forth. I mean, that's what your electors are. These guys are the sages. These are the subject matter experts throughout your state that understand that Constitution. And they get elected, and they're the ones that choose who your president is going to be. And actually, they do all the campaigning to tell you that there's these candidates out there. And that, you know, over here, there's these three guys that I really like, but the one guy that I trust and I don't question is this one person. That's the guy that's going to get my vote. So in other words, they're convincing the people, based on the issues and everything else, who and why they're going to vote the way they do. That's what an elector is supposed to do. That way you vote for that person because there will be another elector that goes, no, we want the government to feed us. We want to be taken care of. And you know, all unconstitutional, contrary. But nevertheless, Madison and Jefferson successfully unseated. They had to know who some of these people were in the states as well as Congress. And we already knew who the president was that had to go. So they had to have a pretty well-marked plan in how to focus and make sure that there was enough challengers that actually got on board with supporting the Republican platform, was a limited government, you know, in line with the Constitution. In other words, I'll just say constitutional compliance. I mean, if I remember correctly, and I know I saw it, and I think it was in my first book, where I cited the Jefferson platform for that election. I don't think I cited the source for that, because at that point in time, I looked at it and wasn't really that academic, but it was the best thing I could get. And I think it was like 9 or 10 planks. It was a very short platform, and almost all of it had everything to do with complying to the Constitution. So now we go into this fact that, okay, they got these negative reports, both Kentucky and Virginia. Jefferson responded while Madison was still working on his response. So Madison responded a month later in what we called the report on the Virginia resolutions. And now we're going to dive into James Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions. And we're going to go through this line by line, because I'm telling you, folks, this is probably one of the most profound documents where Madison really takes time in helping everybody understand why he said what he said, why he did what he did, and how there's, you know, if once you get through this, you'll realize that we are, our hope and our only way out of this is to get representatives to understand this, to understand their role and responsibility in holding one themselves accountable and holding everybody else accountable. And interestingly enough, back in those days, it wasn't really a matter of the morals and those types of things. It was really this idea of constitutional compliance. So Madison didn't go far enough, and I don't think he could have, but he should have. I think he should have called these people enemies of the Constitution, these people that were asserting all of these other, insinuating that the court had jurisdiction, that these, you know, the states aren't the parties anymore, those types of things. So anyway, let's just dive into this. We'll go through this line by line, and I'm sure that as I, you know, help clarify each part of this, it will help you start to see, wow, I never realized that, you know, this is really a compact, that the states really have this ability. How come they don't have a mechanism? This is a question that's I'm going to beg everybody to think about. Why is it today that the states do not have a mechanism, not to create a convention to rewrite the Constitution, but a mechanism to convene the states into an enforcement of their Constitution? In other words, they pull together a tribunal to judge the federal government, their behavior, the individuals in what they're doing, to call them out and say that these people need to be removed. These laws need to be undone. These powers need to be dismantled. That's what he's saying here, folks. And we're 200 some years beyond this, 225, right? So why haven't we got there yet? Because we've been duped and we've been soothsayed into believing what the courts want us to believe and what these evildoers want us to do. So anyway. All right. So Sean, I think, is it your turn? No, it's actually Tammy. Go ahead and read the number one paragraph.
Report of the committee to whom were referred the communications of various state relative to the resolutions of the last General Assembly of this state concerning the alien and sedition laws.
Okay, so that's just an introduction. And so, but folks, the reason why you see this as a 1, 2, 3, 4, what you're looking at, if you're downloading my documents, you're looking at an academic formatted document, because academically you would be citing both the document and the paragraph where you're going to be citing, what you're cutting out and saying, Madison said this in paragraph 18 in this document. And so I do this to simplify my, you know, my citing, so I can create my citations very easily. Because if you don't put the paragraph number in a 6-page document, you got to go through and count it each time. There's 20 some odd paragraphs. It gets old, so you can tell that I've gotten smart in writing academic documents to add paragraph numbers just by putting, you know, highlighting it all and saying, hey, you know, put a number for each of the paragraphs by using that formatting. And voila. So I did this for me, but there's no reason why you can't use this in creating your own either emails, documentation to help elucidate the truth for people. So go ahead. Sean, you're up next. Second paragraph.
Whatever room might be found in proceedings of some of the states who have disapproved of the resolutions of the General Assembly of this Commonwealth, passed on the 21st day of December 1798, for painful remarks on the spirit and manner of those proceedings. It appears to the committee most consistent with the duty as well as dignity of the General Assembly to hasten an oblivion of every circumstance which might be construed into a diminution of mutual respect, confidence, and affection among the members of the Union.
Okay, so in other words, we need to hurry back in reply to these people because they have actually looked at us with a diminished character, diminished capacity, that maybe they don't see us as equals in this union anymore. Keep going. Tammy, it's your turn.
The committee have deemed it more useful task to revise with a critical eye resolutions which have met with their disapprobation, to examine fully the several objections and arguments which have appeared against them, and to inquire whether there can be any errors of fact, of principle, or reasoning, which the candor of the General Assembly ought to acknowledge and correct.
Okay, so now we've basically laying everything out. now the General Assembly ought to acknowledge and correct. So in other words, we've received all their feedback, and now it's time to give a final disputing of their feedback. So basically, he's just setting the stage for everything that follows. And this is where he starts going through the resolutions and actually cites them. So we're going to be rereading these resolutions verbatim, and then Madison is going to explain some of the details of this. So anyway, so up next, go ahead and read that first line or paragraph four.
The first of the resolutions is in the words following: resolved that the General Assembly of Virginia doth unequivocally express a firm resolution to maintain and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of this state against every aggression, either foreign or domestic, and that they will support the government of the United States in all measures warranted by the former.
Okay, so pretty simple. And then he goes into the explanation by citing the first resolution. Okay, so Tammy, read how he kind of explains this.
No unfavorable comment can have been made on the sentiments here expressed to maintain and defend the Constitution of the United States and of their own state against every aggression, both foreign and domestic, and to support the government of the United States in all measures warranted by their Constitution are duties which the General Assembly ought always to feel, to which on such an occasion it was evidently proper to express their sincere and firm adherence.
Okay, so now it looks like, Sean, the way you're in the queue, you're going to be rereading the resolution. So go ahead, the next precursor and then the resolution.
In their next resolution, quote, the General Assembly most solemnly declares a warm attachment to the Union of the States, to maintain which it pledges all its powers, and that, for this end, it is their duty to watch over and oppose every infraction of those principles which constitute the only basis of that union, because a faithful observance of them can alone secure its existence and the public happiness.
Okay, and now he's going to explain this.
The observation just made is equally applicable to this solemn declaration of warm attachment to the Union and this solemn pledge to maintain it. Nor can any question arise among enlightened friends of the Union as to the duty of watching over and opposing every infraction of those principles which constitute its basis and a faithful observance of which can alone secure its existence and the public happiness thereon.
Okay, now the third resolution, which would be read again by Sean.
The third resolution is in the words following: that this assembly doth explicitly and peremptorily declare that it views the powers of the federal government as resulting from the compact to which the states are parties, as limited by the plain sense and intention of this instrument constituting that compact, as no further valid than they are authorized by the grants enumerated in that compact, and that, in case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil and for maintaining within their respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them.
For the most part, this is kind of where Madison stops really reciting everything. I think there's a couple more parts where he goes back into the first, second, or third, and I think he even jumps into the seventh. But nevertheless, as he kind of jumps around, the rest is really now dealing with what they did, why they did this, and how what these other states have come back and said holds no water. Okay, so Tammy, go ahead.
On this resolution, the committee have bestowed all the attention which its important merits. They have scanned it not merely with a strict but with a severe eye, and they feel confidence in pronouncing that in its just and fair construction, it is unacceptably true in its several positions as well as constitutional and conclusive in its inferences.
Okay. So now he goes into, and kind of, I think this is where, well, go ahead. Go ahead, Sean. Let's read this next paragraph that sets up the 14th. Go ahead.
The resolution declares first that it views the powers of the federal government as resulting from the compact to which the states are parties. In other words, that the federal powers are derived from the Constitution and that the Constitution is the compact to which the states are parties.
Plain and simple. Plain and simple. Just laying it out. Like I said, this is all about compact or contract law. Who has the authority? And so Madison is now ready to start chewing or, you know, really whipping up some a can of whoop-ass or what have you. Anyway, let's go ahead into 14 right here.
Clears the position must seem that the federal powers are derived from the Constitution. From that alone, the committee are not unapprised of the late doctrine which opens another source of federal powers, not less extensive and important than it is new and unexpected. The examination of this doctrine will be most conveniently connected with the review of a succeeding resolution. The committee satisfy themselves here with briefly remarking that in all the contemporary discussions and comments which the Constitution underwent, the Virginia ratification debates, it was constantly justified and recommended on the ground that the powers not given to the government were withheld from it.
Okay, so Tammy, right there. So Tammy, this is, no, in these other subsequent paragraphs, I'm going to be interrupting. So far, what you started off with, as Madison just pointed out, clear as the position must seem, that the federal powers are derived from the Constitution. That alone. Okay? And then the last sentence or part fragment of that sentence you're reading states that the committee satisfied themselves here with briefly remarking in all the contemporary discussions and comments which the Constitution underwent. What does he mean there? I mean, that's not, it's a rhetorical question. What he is actually saying is that during the ratification debates, the Constitution was argued. He's saying that in all the contemporary discussions and comments which the Constitution underwent prior to it being ratified, it was constantly justified and recommended on the ground that the powers not given to the government were withheld from it. So just making this very, very clear that the government's powers only come from the Constitution. And that in the constitutional ratification debates of the Constitution, it was justified. In other words, it was sold and stipulated that powers not delegated were withheld from it. So if I stipulate in a contractual agreement that powers not delegated are basically withheld, that becomes a legal binding term and definition. When somebody goes through in the process of working with somebody to get them to agree to commit to doing something, buying a car from you, doing work for you, what have you, and you stipulate that, hey, if you buy this car from me today, right now, if you buy this car from me, I will guarantee we will wash and wax that car every week you own that car. And you go in, you all shake hands, and if you get this person to not make keep them from remembering to add that into the contract, what you just said, now you've placed the burden onto him that he has to prove you stipulated that. But folks, the framers actually had every word written down. In other words, they made sure they wrote down the proceedings of how the Constitution was stipulated. So it's not about whether they said it or not. We actually have it in the ratification debates. This is why we proved earlier this year, going through the cod fishery bills, the cod fishery bounty bill. We went through the Assumption Act. We went through the bank bill. We went through a few cases where Madison himself in Congress read the ratification debates and say, this is how it was stipulated. Folks, why aren't they not doing that today? Because nobody wants to actually go back to these hard definitions. If they did, the government would be reduced down to the limited defined government we have. If you start making the connections another bright light will illuminate your car, and I know it may be late because I know this is an evening drive for people. Please don't have an accident. I'm not trying to have, you know, you drive unsafely, but I'm hoping you see. I hope this really illuminates your mind and your world that they, the ratification debates, and that the framers literally provided the definitions right out there so that everybody, the jurists cannot ignore these things, but they have been. This is why the jurists grabbed the Federalist Papers and not the ratification debates. They understood contract law. We even have a better understanding, a more mature understanding of contract law today, which is why the lawyer, that's not applicable here. I'm telling you, if this was a government contract with a defense contractor and it was all stipulated in, the government would hold them accountable. I'm telling you, they would rake them over the coals for every word that they said in defining and redefining what they were going to do for them. Ah, but see, these ratification debates don't go in any favor for them. It actually destroys their whole world they created. And that's why they're marginalizing it. So here's the big question that I want to interrupt before we go to the rest of this paragraph. I want you to think about this, folks. If we understand that the ratification debates provide that much clarity, then why would they ever want to admit this? And more importantly, who has to understand that these things aren't literally for them? These things are for whom? They're for the states. So in other words, when I get into these debates with these, you know, these law scholars, these professors and so forth, and they say, oh, well, you know, we've understood it to be this, and that's how we're moving forward. Well, that's all fine and dandy. As long as you can get away with that, then that's fine and dandy. But when the parties wake up and they realize that how they see it is the only way that matters, then guess what's going to happen? Tammy, Sean, any ideas what's going to happen when the states realize that if they go and they understand the Constitution based on the ratification debates and they place full context to the few powers that they really have, what's going to happen? They're going to dismantle all of these unconstitutional powers. They're going to get the federal government back into the scope and the framework of the Constitution. Because if they don't, we're dead. This goes back to the question as well as to why is it we do not have any state legislatures in an emergency meetings, emergency sessions today. I mean, I noticed last night, went outside before the sunset, and I saw a big, huge chemtrail just right over our house. They're literally still spraying to kill us, folks. They're doing things to basically set us up so that everything gets thrown away. So with that, we're in the middle of the paragraph 14. So when we come back, we'll probably redo paragraph 14 just for the merit of keeping it in view. And we will wrap all of this up, at least paragraph 14, and move through more of these this report from Madison tomorrow. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.